Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Ollie.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
the Angulo Brothers, a.k.a. the Wolfpack.
Who are the Angulo Brothers? They are 6 brothers who spent the first 18 years of their lives locked inside a New York City apartment by their paranoid father, never stepping foot out of their front door, never interacting with any human beings besides each other, and forced to occupy their monotonous days by watching an endless stream of movies. They became so obsessed with these movies that they started shooting meticulous shot-for-shot remakes of them inside their apartment using an old video camera. But would they ever escape the confines of that tiny apartment? And how do 6 young boys whose only experience with the outside world is from watching thousands of movies react when they're finally thrust into the real thing?
Act 1. I tried to shag them, but it didn't take. Fear is powerful. In fact, some have been known to call it the mind killer. It's also a potent weapon, dangerous tool of oppression, valuable social currency, and addictive drug. It's used to manufacture consent. You should hate these people and be okay with us eradicating them because they want to kill us all. Persuade and manipulate. You should buy our deodorant because if you smell bad, nobody's ever going to date you and you'll be alone forever. And control. If you don't do what I tell you, I will hurt you. But it's also pure opiate to some people. A self-imposed prison. A spiraling obsession that will take your life and raise it from the plane of sanity. It's a product of an increasingly individualistic global society where people increasingly feel like nobody can be trusted. Nothing is what it seems. And all you can do is take care of yourself. Fear is what exists in the vacuum created by lack of community, a strong support system, or the warmth and love of another person. This type of repetitive thought pattern can destroy somebody. It's a slippery slope that can take you from, I think we should be a little careful because there are some dangerous things and people out there in the world, to, let's lock ourselves inside of a tiny apartment forever and never step foot outside again because the world and everything in it wants us dead. And that's a slippery slope that Oscar Angulo just straight up tumbled down face first, and in doing so, created a pit of fear that his entire family would have to spend the next 30 years digging themselves out of. Oscar Angulo and Suzanne Reisenbichler met on the Inca Trail during a backpacking trip to Machu Picchu in Peru in the late 1980s. Oscar was a Peruvian musician and devoted Hare Krishna, acting as a guide during the trip. Suzanne was a hippie from Michigan, visiting the country on her admittedly way too late in the game 1970s style spiritual awakening. They fell in love, or at least maybe Suzanne, an idealistic flower child out of time, fell in love with the idea of Oscar as a vagabond, spiritualist musician outside of the confines of traditional society. They got married in Peru, lived on a Hare Krishna commune for a while, and then moved to the United States to live in West Virginia and start a family. In the early 1990s, not long after moving to West Virginia, the couple moved to California and then eventually New York City. But here's the thing. As Suzanne would start to realize, those same proclivities that made a man mysterious, eclectic, and alluring on the Inca Trail might externalize themselves in other, less favorable ways in a marriage. Oscar was a nonconformist, all right? He was nonconformist bordering on full-blown paranoid delusions. He believed that the secular world was a dangerous, unpredictable place, and that the powers that be controlled humanity through covert propaganda and social conditioning. The world was to be feared, and authority was to be challenged at all costs. The way Oscar chose to challenge the system? By not working. You can't be a cog in the machine if you just refuse to be in the machine entirely. And so they moved into an apartment in the Seward Park Extension housing project in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where the cost of rent was capped at a flat rate of 30% of your gross income, which Oscar and Suzanne scraped together through welfare checks. And though this might not have been exactly what Suzanne signed up for when she fell for Oscar on the peak of Machu Picchu, it's exactly what Oscar wanted. All he cared about was music, his spiritual teachings, and absolving himself from the horrors of the modern world. He wanted to start his own colony of spiritually pure people, a new race of enlightened beings. But he needed people. Oscar became infatuated with the idea that his spiritual idol, the god Krishna, would have 10 children with each of his wives. And so Oscar decided that they would do just that. And Oscar and Suzanne set about literally creating bodies for this grand vision of an isolated colony. Throughout the 90s, the couple had 7 children. Sons Bhagavan, Narayana, Govinda, Mukunda, Krishna, Jagadesh, and their only daughter Vishnu. The reason why they weren't able to have the full 10 children that Oscar wanted? Suzanne's body literally couldn't handle having any more children and they had to stop for medical reasons. As the children began to get older, it became clear that Oscar wasn't just satisfied having his little colony of people molded in his image. He had to control every aspect of their lives. The kids, as well as Susan, weren't allowed to leave the confines of their apartment in the projects except in rare situations. They were homeschooled, locked inside 24/7, and trained to not communicate with other people outside of the family unit.
So we were kind of shut off. Always lived in this apartment in New York, Lower East Side, Manhattan. And we never really communicated with people. We were taught by our father not to talk to strangers, you know, the whole thing. But it was farther than that. It was like, don't even look at people. We didn't make any friends. We were homeschooled. Also the fear that my parents had, because it's New York, anything can happen. My father kind of, I felt he overdid it. Like he was almost too worried, too concerned.
So before we continue on with the story, Dave, I'm just curious, like, when did you first hear about the Wolf Pack, or when did you first become familiar with this story? And also, like, without getting into just, like, the nitty-gritty of this story that we're just kind of starting, like, what are your broad thoughts about what Oscar did with this family? The reasoning behind why he did this and the actual execution of it. Like, what are your general thoughts about it? Other than the obvious of, like, oh, it's fucked up.
I remember when this story kind of came to light because of a critically acclaimed documentary that started making the festival circuits in like the, I don't know, early aughts, maybe early 2010s. And I remember initially being like, oh man, that looks so up my alley. I gotta fucking see this movie. And then after seeing it, sitting in a like state of existential dread, like a cartoon, like your hair blown back, you know, when a bomb goes off. It was that, except for my soul. I think the quickest and most direct way to discuss the Oscar paradigm with Suzanne and his children generally would somewhere kind of settle in, that shit's fucked.
Yeah, and we're going to get into this more later. Like, we don't need to hash all of this out now. But the reason why I ask is because it's like the boiled frog paradigm. The idea that, like, if you put a frog in a jar of water and then slowly raise the temperature, the frog will just boil it to death without realizing it. They'll just kind of drift off into oblivion. And I'm really fascinated with the boiled frog effect of the idea of wanting to protect your children and shelter them from the dangers of the world. and how that can snowball into a cult, basically. And like I said, we'll talk about this more, and it's not to like say like, oh, like Oscar had good intentions and it just got out of hand. Like, that's not what I'm saying at all. And I think we'll learn that that's just simply not the case. But I do think, you know, just based on the thesis that I kind of started off with, there's this idea that I think a lot of people, especially parents, feel about wanting to protect their kids from the dangers that they know exist in the world and sort of like avoid the pitfalls that they experienced growing up. And I'm interested in that gray area between that and then like it getting so out of hand that you have just turned into a tyrannical, controlling maniac.
Moderation, man. Moderation is not terrible.
Yeah, for sure. The kids have described their childhoods by saying that early on they were able to go outside every once in a while, especially in the summer, maybe 9 times a year. And then it was 2 times a year, and then once a year, until eventually it was none. As Oscar fell deeper into his delusions, the siblings were completely cut off from society.
I always, like, metaphorically described our childhood as, like, him being the landowner and us the people who work on the land.
But if you want a more dramatic setting, we were in a prison.
Yeah.
And at night, our cells would lock up.
He was the warden.
You say so?
Yeah. I mean, describing your childhood as a prison and your dad as a warden,
it's pretty fucking bleak, man.
I just want to hit this on the head because it's like, it's a foregone conclusion. And we still haven't even heard the worst of it. But it's a foregone conclusion that what was done to this family, the kids and the wife, is horrible. But the thing that I really want to hammer in on is like, this is a worst case scenario nightmare for somebody who just kind of wants to protect their family and maybe veers into certain controlling behaviors. Like the idea that you would lose the plot so thoroughly in your mission to protect the people that you love that they would end up describing you as a prison warden. That's the nightmare. That's the thing that you, as somebody who's in the role of protector or provider, or even just, you know, somebody who has people that depend on you and that love you and that you want to protect in ways, even if you aren't like their parent figure or something like that. This is like the worst nightmare, that you would somehow get so turned around that you would end up causing this much psychic harm to somebody.
Well, when we first started talking about doing this episode, that's something that first occurred to me, is like, I obviously relate to the children in this story. Not out of any real lived experience that's all that similar, but just because it becomes a metaphor, right? The system is oppressing you, your aspirations are holding you back, whatever. Like, we all can relate to the feeling of being trapped in something in whatever context. But when we first started talking about doing this episode, I was so curious to talk to you about, like, if you related to what Oscar had done in any way. Obviously, the man's mentally ill, and you're not. But as a father, have you had similar impulses, you know?
Yeah, we definitely will explore that. But the short answer is absolutely. Once again, we'll kind of touch on this later, but it's so starkly different from like the story of the Shags. Exploring that story, I wasn't able to relate to Austin, whatever those people's last name was. I forget the last name of the Shags family.
Austin Van Shag?
Wiggin. Talking about the Shags, I was not able to relate to Austin Wiggin at all, because his whole thing was like just this weird obsession with a prophecy and the idea that he felt like he had to do this to fulfill this prophecy. Like, there wasn't really any kind of outward expression of, I'm locking my children in their house and boarding up the windows and doors because I want to protect them. It was a solely selfish act. And there was no feeling of like relation to that at all. But going through this story, there is a level of relation to Oscar and what he did. And it's not like, oh, I can understand why he did this. It's more like what I said before. It's like, this is the nightmare of what you might become if you become too consumed with trying to protect your children and being scared of how the world will react to them and treat them. So yeah, there's a lot of ways in which I think I and a lot of parents could relate to Oscar and his plight of like kind of what he was trying to do. But it's less like, oh, we should give him some slack because he just wanted to protect his kids. And it's more like, this is the nightmare. This is like what you don't want to become. And what's worse, as the kids started to get older and Oscar wanted a stronger grip over the lives of his family, he started to get violent. Oscar and Suzanne started arguing frequently in the apartment, and when things got really out of hand, Oscar would slap her. And if any of the boys interfered, he'd slap them too. Turns out when you want to birth 10 kids and turn them into a mini cult that holes up inside of a New York City apartment and never contacts the outside world, you end up not being that great of a guy. But Oscar, as the meme goes, had two wolves inside of him. And while he desperately wanted to protect his family from the outside world and hated the idea of opting into the evil capitalist system he recognized at the root of the world's problems, he also low-key wanted to be a rock star. And so he saw an opportunity to do what every obsessive father who becomes existentially terrified of society and locks himself and his family away inside of a hermetically sealed household time capsule dreams of. He wanted to use his kids to start a family band. Yeah, that's right. He wanted to shags the fuck out of his kids. So he pieced together all the necessary musical instruments and started forcing his sons to become a band. I kind of thought this was as much levity as you can generate from a story like this. I found it funny that, like, the first draft of his vision for what his family was like, we're going to become like the Nega Partridge family. Instead of a family that roves around the country, we're going to be a family band that just lives inside of this apartment and, like, mails in our demo tapes or something to the record producers.
I mean, honestly, the way TikTok exists now, where things that have some sort of virality to their hook, you could picture that being a thing.
Oh, yeah, that's the sad part. Like, that lady who's, like, building tunnels underneath her house, or that one little boy who has that
bone disease,
Mr. Glass from Unbreakable disease, and his parents obviously force him to be an influencer. Like, he's very clearly just being pushed by his mom to do that, and it's all just very sad because you just have this sad little boy who's already kind of isolated, and then also his parents are just like pushing him to do this thing, and he gets a bunch of hate from people, and that just probably is not good for a child to just receive thousands of hate comments every day and have to read them. The sad thing is that, like, today, if this family existed now the way that they existed 20 years ago, they would absolutely be TikTok viral. They would be huge. They would have 3 million followers.
There's a Philip DeFranco video, and he's just like, you won't believe these crazy families. They're holed up in a fucking place. They all got long hair, and they all kind of look the same. They're remaking movies. Isn't that wild?
Yeah, they would have like 3 million followers, and they'd just be cranking out content. And, like, there would be criticisms of it. There would be people making videos being like, this is problematic, blah, 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 he's abusing these kids. But, like, most people would just look at it and be like, this is cool. There's, like, a family, and they're, like, they're quirky, and they live in their house, and they make music, and, like, most people would just think of it as, like, entertaining content. You got to think about that fact. The fact that if these people were like this today, they would just be, like, a famous YouTube channel. And you got to think about that and recontextualize all of the other family YouTube channels that you know about and you've seen, and just think, like, you have them bucketed in your mind as a certain thing of, like, oh, it's just a family that makes videos. You got to think about it like that and think about all these family YouTube channels and TikTok channels and how any one of them, or maybe all of them, are just this. In the early 2000s, the siblings started practicing covers of popular rock songs that Oscar loved in the hopes that they could one day get discovered and sign a record contract, a form of working for, quote, the man that Oscar was seemingly okay with. But Oscar Angulo didn't have the discipline of the tyrannical cult dads that came before him, and he couldn't keep his sons focused on their musical training, because as they aged, they started developing different interests. Locked inside the confines of their tiny apartment, and left with nothing but the random junk they could find around the house, the Angulo siblings became obsessed with making stuff. Costumes, sculptures, murals, paintings, all cobbled together from trash and household objects. Their house slowly started to pile up with random DIY works of art straight from the imagination of the seven loneliest children on planet Earth. So obviously the listener can't really benefit from this, but just to describe this, this is a scene from the documentary about this family that we'll talk about later, but it's on Halloween, and basically it's showing, like, their house and the way that they've just, like, completely decked out their entire apartment with all these, like, meticulously crafted homemade DIY Halloween decorations, and they're all wearing these, like, homemade Halloween costumes that they've created. And they're all, like,
made of like duct tape and cardboard and paint. And it's just like this weird, like we'll talk about this more later, but the aesthetic can only be described as that movie from that Michel Gondry movie, Be Kind, Rewind. It's their whole like lives is just that aesthetic.
And then they're parading around a cross covered in straw and then chanting, "This is Halloween." And then they all simultaneously put red candles that have been lit to the cross effigy and burn it in their apartment.
Yeah, they just start a fire in their apartment. And like their mom's there. So it's not like they're just like doing this in secret, but like their mom is with them. Going in circles around this straw effigy that they made, and then they just set it on fire. And like somehow it doesn't burn down the apartment. Like they kind of stamp it out, but they just straight up start a fire.
This is fire hazard. This is fire hazard.
And their mom is just like, she's just right there alongside them, setting the fire herself. But yeah, it's really interesting. And this kind of sets the tone for the whole episode of like what the brothers were into and the way that they wild away their time. But there's like the double whammy of the fact that they're not allowed to go outside and they can't like go and experience anything in the outside world. And also they're super poor because their parents don't work and they just live off of welfare checks and the payments that they get from the state for her mom homeschooling them. And so they just like build a world inside of their apartment with like cardboard and tape. But the boys' fascination with making costumes and props was only a symptom of a larger obsession. An obsession that Oscar himself would ironically introduce them to. Despite the fact that their dad was religiously afraid of the outside world to the point where he kept everybody in his family from being exposed to it directly, this fear paradoxically didn't seem to extend to pop culture. And from an early age, he started bringing tons and tons of movies into the house. And not just weird religious focus on the family type movies that you might assume. Like movies. Martin Scorsese films, comic book movies, horror movies, and even Golden Age classics. He brought every movie he could get his hands on back to the apartment, and his kids started devouring them. And this is just a brief aside about something that I want to talk about more later, but it's also really interesting, and this is a way bigger topic that I really want to talk with you about in general. But as the story unfolds, you start to see like a lot of things that you pick up on as like patterns of the way that boys who might be completely shut off from the outside world and only experience anything through movies and books, and you start to pick up on behaviors and little like signifiers of that. And one of the interesting things that if you read between the lines, you get a sense of is they've watched thousands upon thousands of movies. In fact, at one point, there was a random interview where Makunda said that they easily have watched 10,000 movies. But as you start to dig into the types of movies that they watch, it's really interesting because you got to think about this. Like, they did not have the internet. They did not even have a computer. They had no idea about like the outside world or culture, no access to finding out any kind of information at all. And so like, because of that, their tastes in movies and the types of movies that they watched, despite the fact that they've watched 10,000 movies, the types of movies that they've watched clearly were recommendations that they got out of a like 10,000 movies you should watch before you die book. Like, it's very obvious that that's how they learned about movies. They probably got a hold of some book at some point that just had a list of movies, and they just started going down the line and being like, go get this movie, go get this movie, go get this movie. And that's how they learned movies, because despite the fact that they've watched such a breadth of movies, the actual depth of the movies is very shallow. Like, all of the movies that they've watched are just all like mainstream blockbusters, and then like classic movies that you would read about in screenwriting books like Tootsie and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Never in any of this material do they ever mention like, yeah, I love that obscure horror indie, like they know nothing about anything besides like mainstream blockbusters and then like classic movies that would be in books. And it's very obvious that they learned about all these things from a book that they read. They probably just had an encyclopedia or something.
Which is really interesting because it kind of shows you the penetrative ability of the movie machine. You know, they always say that film is a machine built to generate empathy. And that's partly true, but it's also a machine built to engage in commerce. And even when you are shuttled away from the world in a existential island life with just you and your five brothers, that mechanism of capitalism is so extreme that even there, Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather exists.
Yeah, and it's the greatest movie of all time. It somehow is able to trickle in. It's funny because a thing I would compare this to, like this story in many shades, reminds me of the movie Dogtooth. It's like Dogtooth is almost literally just like a slightly more extreme version of what literally happened with this family. Like in the movie Dogtooth, it was a little bit more extreme where like the parents literally did not allow them to have any exposure to pop culture from the outside world. And any pop culture that they did have, they would like recontextualize it. They had like Frank Sinatra albums and the father told them that Frank Sinatra was his dad. And like he would show them the music and be like, this is my dad. He's Frank Sinatra. He sings. But it's the same thing where in that movie, living on a compound, a father who meticulously controls every aspect of his children's lives, does not allow them any kind of access to the outside world, and any concept that hints at the outside world, they control the definition of it and change it. Like travel, that's another word for salt. Like making up definitions for words that imply going away. Even in that world, they still had Frank Sinatra. It finds its way in, even if they lied and said it's his dad. They were obsessed, not just with the art and craft of the films, not just the entertainment factor, the ability to while away their countless hours stuck inside, but they were obsessed with the window into the world outside that the films became. It was their only connection to humanity, their only glimpse into how people outside of their front door lived their lives. And throughout the years, through painting and practicing music and learning to cook gourmet meals for themselves and all the little hobbies and activities they devoured to pass the time, the one constant was movies. It became the sole passion of the six brothers. But it wasn't just watching the movies that they were obsessed with. Eventually, they became obsessed with living the movies, stepping into the literal footsteps of the characters inside the TV screen and living normal lives vicariously through them. Or at least what these six shut-ins thought was normal. And yeah, the other thing about this story is like going back to the discussion of like, oh, do you relate to Oscar Angulo and like what he was doing as a parent? I think overall, this story, it serves as like the worst case scenario of a lot of relatable things, because we talked about the parent perspective and then you were talking about relating to the boys. And I think that a lot of kids growing up that may have felt isolated, that may have felt like they didn't have a lot of connection to their peers, couldn't make friends, had trouble expressing themselves. I think that a lot of those types of kids can relate to a much less extreme version of what's going on in this story, where it's like, yeah, you know, I was an isolated kid and I did have trouble making friends. And ultimately, I did end up kind of like living vicariously through movies, and I'd watch TV shows and movies, and I would kind of like, those were my friends. And that was kind of how I learned some aspects of socialization, because I just wasn't really having those experiences directly with other people at the time. I think a lot of people can relate to those things. And then this is just like the extreme version of that, where it's like, no, not just like, oh, I had trouble connecting with people and I live vicariously through movies. Like, no, you literally did not have contact with people. And your only way of understanding what the world was like was by watching movies and kind of like assuming that those were just reconstructions of real life. And so learning like culture and learning human behavior and interaction through those movies.
Can you imagine like you've never been outside, you've never seen a car, and then you watch like Steven Spielberg's Minority Report and you're like, man, if we could just go outside and see these flying cars, and then seeing Godfather and being like, wait, what? Oh, so this takes place in the past. So this is before we had flying cars. And then you go out on your like annual summer trip and you're like 8 years old and you're like, wait, flying cars don't exist? Fuck.
As much as that's a joke and like they had enough of a grasp on reality to know that science fiction movies were not real life, you're not actually wrong. And we're going to talk about this, but like they really did form expectations of what life was that were based on how life was depicted in movies, and we're kind of culture shocked to go outside and realize that like, oh, it's not actually like that. That was just a romanticized version of reality, or it was magical realism, or, you know, when you write a script, you make all the characters, you know, seamlessly have conversations where there's no dead air. Like, they actually were, like, surprised by some of the ways that reality did not match their expectations based on movies. And also, as we'll talk about later, their own personalities and ways that they interacted with people were shaped by movies in interesting ways that, like I said, we'll talk about. It was the mid-2000s, and the siblings, the Wolf Pack as they would come to be known, had been cooped up inside of their Lower East Side apartment since the mid-90s. And the whole time, they had done nothing but watch movies together. They had no social skills, no experience with the outside world, and no idea how real life was actually supposed to be. So instead, they knew life the way that it was depicted in their movies. And they wanted to try and live that life in any way they could. At the same time, Mukunda Angulo, the fourth youngest son, was developing a budding passion for filmmaking. And so began the new thing that they could do to pass their time and also find connection with the world. They started shooting meticulous DIY shot-for-shot remakes of their favorite movies. Yeah, we're going to watch a few of these. Well, honestly, these aren't really like the actual OG home movies that they made. You can tell that these were like reenactments of them that they shot exclusively for the documentary. I don't really know why that is. A lot of the stuff in the documentary that's presented like it was them in the past making these movies, you can tell that they reshot it for the documentary's sake. And I don't know if that's because they just didn't have access to the footage anymore or what, but this isn't the actual real original version of this. But it just gives you a sense of kind of like what they were doing. But we're going to watch a few clips from these remakes of these movies that they made. And obviously, this is really not for any kind of benefit of the listener. Like, they can't see these things, but it's just more for us to watch and kind of talk about.
Just reenacting.
Sorry. That's reenacting Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
Will you please hold me? Yes.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy? Or are you going to bite?
Hey, look, you two assholes, calm the fuck down. Hey, back off.
What are we on a playground here? Am I the only professional?
his Steve Buscemi voice is so good.
Reenacting the famous ear-cutting scene with Michael Madsen.
I'm so scared. Kiss a fire in my chair. And I'm going to get downstairs.
God damn you, Joe. Don't make me do this.
Larry, stop pointing that fucking gun at my dad!
A couple of things. One, whichever one of the brothers made the duct tape guns, respect, man. Those duct tape guns are real good.
Yeah, well, it's like everything. All the props, all the movie props, they're just like, they're cobbled together from cereal boxes and duct tape.
It's amazing. The second thing that immediately strikes me is because the brothers look so similar, it's really fucking weird because it looks like five guys that are the same guy. And then a child of that same guy doing stuff.
Yeah, it's bigger than that, actually. It's not just that they look similar. They all very closely resemble each other. In fact, it's just Mukunda. He has like a more unique set of facial features. All the rest of the brothers, they just look like they're all twins. And two of them are twins. But five of them just look like they're all twins. Like they're quintuplets that are just smaller. But it's more than that. And that's the really interesting thing. As we get into this story, what's going to kind of take shape is that the main character of this story kind of ends up becoming Mukunda. He's the one that sort of like rises to the front and ends up kind of becoming the protagonist. And as we'll come to learn, and I don't want to give away too much, but the reason for that is because I don't think I've ever seen any example of a group of people that are so in sync with each other that they're all essentially just the same person. The really interesting thing about the brothers, especially if you watch the documentary and get a better sense of them, is that something about how long they were isolated together, the fact that they were socialized completely in this homogenous environment where they only had each other to bounce off of and they experienced the same things in the exact same way, They watched exactly the same movies. There was zero level of individualism between them. They are like a hive mind. They're like the Borg. There's no variation in their personalities at all. They all have the exact same personality. They have the exact same taste in movies to the point where like their list of top 10 movies is the same. They all have the exact same ranking of top 10 movies. And it's only by nature of the fact that Mukunda breaks free of the programming a little bit and does this rebellious act that we'll talk about later that he differentiates himself to the point where he stands out and becomes the protagonist. It's only because he does something slightly different than everybody else that he becomes unique. The rest of them, they're just the same person. It's really weird and fascinating and kind of sad and really uncanny. They're just the same guy. There's zero variation in personalities. And I mean, I'm sure now as they've gotten out into the world, they've have. But at the time of this, when they were freshly out of this period of isolation, they just are the same guy. They have all the same tastes. When they go out together, they all dress the same way. I've never seen anybody this in sync with each other ever in my life.
Look at me. Look at me. You see, this is how crazy Batman's made Gotham. You want order in Gotham? Batman must take his mask off and turn himself in. Oh, and every day he doesn't, people will die. Starting tonight. I'm a man of my word.
So that was obviously them recreating that scene from The Dark Knight whenever the Joker is like, they find that tape of him and he's got like a hostage and he's calling out the Batman where Mukunda is playing Heath Ledger's Joker. And then I just want to watch this last one. This is from their remake of Pulp Fiction.
You must be Jules, which would make you Vincent. I think fast, I talk fast, and I need you guys to act fast if you want to get out of this. So pretty please, with sugar on top. Clean the fucking car.
Don't be looking at me like that, right? I can feel your look.
Oh, man, I will never forgive your ass for this.
It's funny that the Vincent Vega hair is not that different from their actual hair. So they just, like, tuck their ponytail in the back of the jacket.
Motherfucker who said that shit never had to pick up any pieces of brain on account of your dumb ass.
I got a threshold, Jules. I got a threshold for the abuse that I will take. I could blow.
Oh, you ready to blow?
Yeah, I'm ready to blow.
Well, I'm a mushroom cloud lane motherfucker. Every time my fingers touch brain, I'm super fly TNT.
That's a pretty solid John Travolta impression. That was pretty good.
I have two things to say, two things to ask you about. So the first thing is they show a selection of their remake of Pulp Fiction. And you've got one of the brothers playing Vincent Vega and one of the brothers playing Jules, and the guy who's playing Samuel L. Jackson's role, he's got like a weird, like, I don't know if it's like painted on or if it's like tape, but he's got like a beard and mustache and he's wearing like an afro wig that I don't know what it's made out of. And you heard the performance. So we just saw that little selection of it. In the full shot for shot remake, do you think
100% 100% he's wearing blackface? 100%.
Not just blackface, but do you think he was going for the hard R's?
Oh, 100%. Hard R's. Blackface, 100%. But the documentarians in this like staged one were like, guys, we got to keep you guys likable. So we're just not going to deal with that.
There's a feature length movie where that guy says the N-word like 100 times. But the other thing I wanted to talk about and kind of ask you about is in these three selections, one thing that's very subtle to me and is very fascinating to me, and this is a bigger concept. I keep saying this, but there's just so much to cover. I want to talk about this more later, but just in a little bit of a touching on it now. One interesting thing that I kind of observed from this is later on, Mukunda does this TED Talk after the documentary comes out. And basically the TED Talk is all about escaping from the traumas of your life through your imagination. And he's talking about how, you know, they escaped from this situation that they were in by retreating into their imagination and making these movies and building all these props and things like that. And then later on, Mukunda starts to try to make his own movies. But the interesting thing to observe or see is, like, I don't want to sound mean when I say this, but the brothers and the things that they did, to me, it less seems like them utilizing their imagination. And it seems like carbon mimicry. In those selections we just watched, I just wanted to point out and flag that, like, it's really interesting because, you know, whenever you, like, an actor wants to portray a role, they want to sort of like bring something of their own to it. And even like impressionists who are trying to mimic a person, they like develop their own style of it. So like you have all these impressions of somebody like Donald Trump, and they're all like good impressions, but each impressionist like brings their own unique style to it. So you see like, oh, there's like the James Austin Johnson Trump impression that's this way and it's very good. But then there's like the Frank Caliendo, is that his name, impression. Even when people are trying to mimic people, they bring their own unique flavor to it because you kind of have to, because there's a lot of impressionists. So you can't just do like an exact Trump impression because somebody else could do that. You have to bring your own thing to it. But like these brothers, the way that their personalities were shaped by these movies, and also just the way that they made the movies and acted in the movies, they have this almost photographic memorization of like the exact human levers of behavior and inflection that they got from watching those movies. So like in the Reservoir Dogs one, the guy who's playing Chris Penn's character, the way he says, "Stop pointing that gun at my dad," he says it in exactly the same inflection that Chris Penn says it in the movie. Like when you hear it, it reminds you of the literal line of dialogue from the film because he says it in the exact same way. And then in the Pulp Fiction remake, whenever the Vincent Vega character says, "Don't give me that look, or I can feel your look," he turns around and he does like a motion like this and he goes, "Psh." He like makes a sound and he like flicks his hand. And the reason for that is because if you watch the movie, after John Travolta says, "Don't give me that look, I can feel your look," he turns around and he pushes open a screen door. And he goes out of it. And he like exactly mimicked that motion of opening the screen door and making the sound effect of the screen door opening, even though he was just miming it and there was no actual door there. So there's like this really interesting phenomenon happening where I'm noticing less like, oh, we're using our imaginations to create this world, and more like, let's just like exactly beat for beat, verbatim, mimic this as much as we possibly can.
But don't you think it is just imagination in a different way? Because imagination, once you've lived a life, is like you're synthesizing multiple real life experiences that you've had or things that you've seen in the world and creating something that could have been or will be one day, or, you know, a self-perpetuating or self-fulfilling engine of creativity, right? But because they literally don't have any experience to draw on, the act of imagination is, imagine if I was in an experience, but the only experience they have to draw on is the events of these films.
Yeah, like imagination in a vacuum. I can see that. I see what you're saying. Yeah, and like I said, I'm not even trying to say that in an insulting or like diminutive way. I just picked up on this thing watching this documentary, watching a bunch of the interviews, watching the short films and the remakes that they made, where there's like this almost virtuosic component of mimicry, where they're reenacting these things like verbatim, down to like the intonation of the way that people are saying lines in a really interesting way. And then that sort of externalizes itself in their actual personalities, where then you sit and you watch like interviews with them and you can tell that they're trying to sound like a character in a movie, which is really fascinating. Mukunda would sit and watch a movie with the subtitles on and meticulously handwrite all the lines of dialogue on paper. And then he would go to a manual typewriter and type up the entire thing into screenplay format that he learned from reading screenwriting guidebooks. The kids weren't allowed to have computers. In fact, they'd never even used one. So the entire process of creating these scripts was totally manual and took days. He would also draw intricate covers to the scripts that were full color replications of the film's poster. So they were more than just documents they used to memorize the dialogue and blocking from the movies. They were in and of themselves works of art. In this way, they made meticulous, be kind, rewind style, shot for shot remakes of dozens of their favorite movies on a video camera that their dad was able to procure for them. It became their sole source of expressing themselves, the medium through which they expressed emotions, fears, hopes, and dreams. It made them feel like living was possible because somebody else lived these lives and they were reenacting them like some sort of talismanic ritual that confirmed their own existence. but focusing their lives around movies and pop culture while also simultaneously being completely isolated from the real world had an inevitable effect on the way they viewed the world and expressed themselves off camera. It wasn't just within those mini DV tapes where they experienced the world as larger than life. The mannerisms and drama from the movies bled into the way they acted and spoke to each other in real life. They themselves started to become indistinguishable from the characters they played.
If I didn't have movies, life would be pretty boring, and there wouldn't be any point to go on, you see. So movies opened up another world. But I always thought I would be a lonely person, live in solitude. That was just my view. So, and it's shown a lot in movies, too. The shy, lonely kid. That was my childhood.
You have to see it in order to get the full effect, but even listening to it, you can kind of tell. But like, that was just an interview segment from the documentary. But you can tell that like the way that he is speaking is patterned after a monologue from a movie. Like a normal socialized person does not speak like that. And you can tell that his only frame of reference for how you talk about yourself is the way that a character in a movie monologues. And he's mimicking that in just this interview piece that he's doing where he's talking about his life.
Yeah, when he says, like, I always thought I'd be a lonely person living in solitude. That to me feels like a line from like Donnie Darko or something. You know what I mean? It feels like Catcher in the Rye. Like, I'm just a misunderstood guy and I'm out here doing this shit.
Yeah, 100%.
And the Lord of the Rings. Who doesn't like the Lord of the Rings? So I put it forward.
What we have here is a variety of different. See, we have Citizen Kane and Casablanca, which most people consider to be the greatest movies ever made. Most people consider Citizen Kane number one all the time. We have a collection of horror films like Manhunter, The Hills Have Eyes, Blue Velvet.
So I wanted to show that part because it goes back to two things I was saying. So the first thing is just, you know, him listing off those movies. Like, once again, the movies that he's listing off, you can tell that they are all from like a book about like the greatest movies of all time, right? Every movie choice they talk about is just clearly from a book that they've got. And the other thing is he says that thing where he says most people think that Citizen Kane is the greatest movie of all time. And I found that so fascinating because it's almost like watching an alien who's like come to Earth and they've learned about human culture by just like putting a TV screen and like downloading, you know, all of history's media. And then that's how they learn about the history of Earth. It's just by watching every movie and reading every book and listening to every album. And then that's how they interpret the world. Because to say that, like, most people do not think that Citizen Kane is the best movie of all time. Specifically, Citizen Kane is ranked as the number one movie of all time on a lot of like academic lists about movies. You know, for the longest time, it was the number one movie of all time ranked by the AFI list. I think it's been replaced by Vertigo at this point. But for a long time, it was Citizen Kane. And a lot of film academics consider it the best movie of all time. Most people do not think that Citizen Kane is the greatest film of all time. Most people don't even know what the fuck Citizen Kane is. And it's really interesting for him to say most people think that because it shows that he has not learned that information from interacting with the world. He learned it from a book that he read. It's still a mystery as to why Oscar Angulo wanted so desperately to keep his children away from the corruption of the secular world and yet had no problem with them learning about it through movies. Probably because he didn't actually give a shit about any of that secular world bullshit and was just a paranoid, controlling asshole. Either way, he couldn't have expected that introducing them to movies, which in turn stoked larger-than-life personalities and aspirations in them, would lead to his stranglehold over their lives beginning to crumble. But in 2010, at the age of 15, Makunda decided that enough was enough and he would venture out into the world by himself for the first time in years.
Hey, it's
Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Act 2. That lady sure does love her some Fields. One day in January of 2010, 15-year-old Makunda waited until his father was out grocery shopping. He knew he'd be gone for several hours, and it was his only opportunity. He put on a black jumpsuit and his homemade Michael Myers mask, figured out how to unlock the front door of the apartment, asked his brothers to wish him luck, and left. He wore the mask because he felt vulnerable and wanted to walk out into the world in anonymity. He also figured that if he ran into his dad, he wouldn't recognize him, because, you know, it's probably some other teenager wearing a Michael Myers mask made out of cereal boxes and duct tape. He wandered blocks away from his apartment and just started stalking around, going into random stores, looking at the people and the things, soaking in as much of the real world as he possibly could. In a weird way, through the eye holes of his mask, he still kind of felt like he was watching a movie. It's like he wasn't actually there, just observing through a screen like he was still stuck back in his apartment. Unfortunately, others didn't see it that way. They definitely knew he was there, and they were creeped out by a mysterious figure in a mask lurking around the aisles of their stores. Eventually, somebody called the cops on Makunda. The police showed up and detained him, demanding to know where he lived and why he was creeping around in a mask. Makunda didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to tell them the truth. He went catatonic. But it didn't matter. This was the beginning of the end of the hermetically sealed life of seclusion for the Angulo family. The police got as much of the story as they could out of Makunda, and he tried to get them to take him back home to his apartment. But they didn't. Instead, they checked him into a psychiatric hospital for assessment. He stayed there for several days, and ironically enough, got some of the first human interaction with anybody outside of his immediate family through the other patients. Once the doctors there felt like they'd done a good enough assessment of Makunda, they released him back to his family. Makunda described the experience as being like one flew over a cuckoo's nest, because of course he did. But the genie was out of the bottle, and the authorities knew about the Angulo family's arrangement. At first, there were talks of potential child abuse, getting the state involved in the situation. But ultimately, Oscar and Suzanne were able to argue that they were licensed to homeschool the children, provided food for them, and kept the apartment clean, and therefore weren't actually doing anything legally wrong. However, things were going to have to change. They couldn't continue keeping them locked inside 24 hours a day. The state mandated that the children would all need to get into therapy. But it wasn't just the state getting involved that ushered in change. Something about going out that day changed Makunda. He'd had enough of listening to his dad and doing what he was told.
Daddy was frightened of what I just did because no one had ever done that. That was the day I kind of like tore off the soldier necklace and threw it and walked away. Since that day, I said I refuse to talk to you. I refuse to take your orders. We're no longer father and son anymore.
Yeah, another interesting little thing there where he does that he tore off the soldier necklace.
Not dog tags, soldier necklace.
Yeah, another sort of clumsy grasping at filtering a life experience through the lens of a movie reference in a really interesting way. And as you said, like, even the actual terminology is kind of off, where it's clearly just an impressionistic interpretation of an emotional experience that he has extrapolated through a movie. It's not technical. It's not like, it's like that scene in a movie where the soldier tears off his dog tags and throws them at his sergeant. It's a more impressionistic, emotional version of a movie reference. But also, once again, it's interesting the parallels between this and that movie Dogtooth, where it was the oldest daughter, but in the same way, the daughter finally sort of hits a wall with this seclusion and the isolation and the oppression, and she escapes. You know, spoiler alert for that movie, but it's interesting that Makunda almost parallels that, even though he's not the oldest, but he parallels that journey of like his having enough with the situation and his bravery sort of like creates this awakening for everybody. It's this reverberation of an awakening for his entire family. It wasn't all good for the Wolf Pack, though. They were struggling with the state-mandated therapy sessions, not feeling comfortable sharing their feelings so openly with other people. And what's worse, the state also wanted them to be enrolled in public school, which none of them wanted to do, much preferring their mom's homeschooling. Speaking of their mother, how did Suzanne feel about all this? Most of the information about the story that exists seems to really gloss over her perspective, instead mostly focusing on the kids and their domineering father. In the documentary about the Angulo family, which we've been hearing clips from and we'll discuss later on in the story, she tends to hang in the background, mostly silent. There aren't any extensive interviews with her in the same way that there are with the boys. You get the sense from watching her in the margins of the story that she's a woman whose life has passed her by. Someone who had big hopes and dreams in her youth that were just kind of wrenched out of her hands while she stood by and let it happen. Somebody who, rather than being forced to live a life she never wanted, was just too polite to ever say no. And while I'd love to delve deeper into her part of the story here because I find it very fascinating, tragic, and worth exploring, our episode will also spend very little time on Suzanne, quite frankly because there's just barely any information about her. The most developed impression we get of how she feels about everything is a handful of quotes from the documentary and various news articles where she seems uniquely obsessed with the fantasy of her kids getting to play in fields. Like, for some reason, she's just really into the idea of specifically fields.
What I really wanted and what I really saw, I really thought that when I was raising my children, they would be growing up in a place with, you know, green fields. And but they didn't have that, you know, and I feel because I had that. And I wanted that for them. You know, to be able to go out and roam the forest, that was important to me. And, you know, just to go out and play in a field or have some place, some fields that were close or, you know, how you see in movies, you know, kids go running through the neighbor's meadow, you know, to get to the forest that they built some tree house in or something like that. Something like that. I'd always thought I wanted that for them.
It's really interesting because it's not just this part, but there's actually multiple other parts of the documentary, as well as quotes from some news articles and other stuff online, where she just repeats that thing where when they ask her like, oh, you know, how do you feel about this? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on this? She says that she just wants her kids to be able to play in fields, or like that's what she envisioned was them being able to play in fields. She just repeats that over and over again. In some ways, it's kind of funny because it's like she just keeps saying fields over and over again. Like she can't think of another thing. She just keeps focusing on this idea of them running through fields. But it's also like very sad. Because it's like she is so traumatized by her experience that the only fantasy she can conjure is just like the polar opposite of being stuck in a tiny apartment. It's like she can't even like fantasize about anything more in depth than just like, I want to be outside in a place that doesn't have walls.
I mean, fields is like an internal metaphor for her, but also a very literal thing as well, which is exactly what you're saying. It's so fucking dark.
But at any rate, this was the beginning of a new era for the Wolf Pack. Though they stayed homeschooled, they started leaving the house on their own. At first, just a few of the older kids, and then eventually the whole crew as a group. They ventured out into the world and started exploring the city for the first time in over a decade. And seemingly feeling like his grand vision for a new colony of perfect children of God had been corrupted by the incident with Makunda, Oscar didn't try to stop them. He just retreated from the family, no longer forcing them to stay inside, no longer exacting his strict rule of law on them. He resigned himself to his room with an endless stream of television while his family started carving out their own independence. And this is also a really unique part of this story that isn't like the movie Dogtooth or isn't really like any cult story I've heard. And it's not like the Shags. In the Shags, there was this period of life where they were confined inside and forced to make this music by their dad. And then ultimately what ended up stopping that or bringing that to a close is that he died. He had a heart attack and died. And that ended the era of them being locked inside of their house. But even later on in life, even recently, they still have this reverence for their dad. Even as adults, even as people in their late 50s, and even though their dad has been dead for decades, they still think of him as like in charge. And they still have this like, oh, like my dad wouldn't like that kind of attitude in interviews and things. And usually that's, you know, how it happens. Like a cult falls whenever the cult leader fucking dies, or everybody dies, or there's some kind of like toppling of the power dynamic in that way, like a violent toppling of the power dynamic. In this situation, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before, but basically one of these brothers, Mukunda, he gets pushed too far and he works up to bravery to just basically say no for the first time. And he just defies the rules that have been set in place by Oscar for 15 years, 16 years. And then Oscar is basically just like, oh, fuck. And then he just like gives up and he just like retreats away and they're just free. Like they still live in the house with him. He's still there. He just relinquishes control over to his family. I've never seen anything like that in any story I've ever read like this.
How much of that do you think is because of the legal ramifications? Is that just like a, oh, this is the end of an era, I'm going to get depressed and watch The Price is Right for 24 hours? Or is it like, oh, I realized that this is going too far. Like, I realized that a while ago, but now I'm genuinely concerned of like legal risk to myself. And now that my children are in like court mandated therapy or whatever, he's like worried about it. And that's why he retreats, because he's just like, I'm not going to jail for this bullshit.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's like a large component of it, especially because like when you, once again, we'll cover this later, but whenever they finally start to like talk to Oscar in the documentary, which they don't do for the whole thing until the last like 10 minutes, I think rightfully so. He's like totally trying to hand wave it. He's just like, ah, I didn't mean to do anything. Like, I don't know. It was, I think they just interpreted it wrong. And I definitely think that it's like he was doing this for all these years in total seclusion. And it was like he was the master of his own domain. And then like the state came in and then there was a documentary filmmaker and he was just like, oh, fuck, like I'm out exposed in the open now. Like, I'm going to go to jail. And then he starts the backpedal of like, oh, no, I wasn't doing anything. I'm just in here watching TV. I think they just misinterpreted what I said. It totally is like a backpedal where he's just like, if not legal ramifications, then certainly just like social ramifications. His behavior is exposed. And he suddenly is just like, now that people are seeing me, like, I don't want to be judged. I don't want people to, like, think I'm an asshole. And so he's just like, I wasn't doing anything. They were allowed to leave whenever they wanted. I think they just got the wrong idea about what I said.
I think they just never wanted to leave the house for 18 years.
I was just trying to protect them.
I think they're just being dramatic, you know. I think, you know, we could have gone to the fields if Suzanne wanted to. She just never wanted to go to the fields.
Despite their newfound freedom and their father's complete withdrawal from controlling them, they still struggled with a lifetime of indoctrination. They could intellectually recognize that their father had filled their heads with a bunch of paranoid nonsense about how scary and unsafe the world outside was, but they were still emotionally arrested by the ideas. Whenever exploring the streets of New York City, the brothers would often be scared of getting mugged. They didn't want to ride the subway because of what they perceived as a criminal element that hung out on the train. They felt paranoid about people following them, and they were petrified of talking to anybody. The excursions out onto the streets of the city were as much exposure therapy and an exercise in overcoming their deeply ingrained prejudices about the outside world as they were fun adventures. And it turned out that maybe in some ways, Oscar might have had a point, because it doesn't seem like the state employees that asserted themselves into the lives of the Angulo family exactly had their best interests at heart. One day, out of the blue, the family were all sitting in their apartment, minding their own business, when their front door was kicked open, and a full-blown SWAT team stormed in, pointing assault rifles at them. The entire family, including all the children, were handcuffed and held against the wall as the SWAT team searched their house. It turned out that somebody who at some point had entered their apartment, likely one of the state employees involved in assessing the safety of the household, had spotted some of the boys' handmade cardboard prop guns, mistaken them for real ones, and alerted the authorities. The Angulo family were being searched for illegal firearms. The SWAT team tore the apartment apart and collected all of their dozens of fake cardboard guns. Eventually, they determined that there were no actual weapons in the house, and the whole thing had been a false alarm. They apologized to the family and left, an incident unfortunately only reinforcing Oscar's teachings that strangers weren't to be trusted. But as it turned out, A stranger was exactly the person who was going to turn their lives around. One day, 5 years after Makunda's daring journey out into the world, the six brothers were out running through the streets of the Lower East Side when they happened to bump into filmmaker Crystal Moselle. Allegedly, she saw the brothers running past her on the sidewalk and was so taken and intrigued by their look and energy that she just started chasing after them, introduced herself, and initiated a friendship.
Spots them and does a double take.
I was just like walking down the street and all of a sudden it was six of them and I ran after them. There's like nothing I could have done.
The brothers who consider movies their religion ask Crystal what she does for a living. The first person they meet, and she is a movie maker. It feels like fate.
We shared the same passion. It immediately made a connection from there.
They arrange to meet, and soon the brothers invite her for dinner at their apartment. Crystal has no idea she is the first outsider ever allowed into the apartment.
You're actually our first guest to be invited over.
Really?
Yeah.
Ever?
Yeah. Never invited anybody over before.
Why not?
Because we didn't have friends.
He had revealed to me that I was one of their first friends, and that was a huge, like, what?
You didn't know that.
I was your first friend?
Crystal only gradually learns about the confines of the boys' childhood. She starts documenting as they experience life on the outside for the first time.
So this is actually a part of the story that I kind of don't buy. So according to Crystal, the director of the Wolfpack documentary that sort of just brought this story to the world, she was just walking outside and the brothers just like ran by her and she just like started running after them. And then they just like started talking and they became friends. And then they like invited her back to their house. And at this point, she knows nothing about them other than she just was for whatever reason intrigued by them. And she goes back to their house. And over the course of like a couple visits to their house, slowly starts to learn about the reality of the situation. This idea that they had been locked inside of their house for like 18 years and had only recently been allowed to go outside. And then as she's hanging out with him and learning this, she starts to piece together the idea of like, I should start filming this stuff. We should make a movie about this. And I kind of don't buy that. I kind of don't believe that she was just outside and saw a bunch of boys running by and then just chased them and then just happened to like strike gold. And this group of kids that she just for some reason started chasing happened to have one of the most fascinating stories of all time. I think that this is like a little bit of kayfabe that was crafted jointly by the brothers and her, where like, I don't know how they met. Maybe they posted on social media about like their story and she saw it and got in contact with them, or like they went to some kind of like Q&A for indie filmmakers and she was there and they approached her and talked about it. And whatever reason, the way that they met was like not super romantic. It was just kind of like, oh, I just saw them posting on Craigslist, something like that. And it just like wasn't particularly interesting. And so they like made up a more romantic origin story. I kind of don't believe that she just was like, something about my filmmaking instincts tells me to chase those boys.
I don't actually have an idea of what it was, but that origin just doesn't seem plausible. That just doesn't seem real, especially in a world where they're like, we don't know anyone. Sure, of course, we're going to get up the gumption to invite this attractive blonde woman back to our house. That's definitely something I would do as someone who has never like spoken at length with another human not related to me by blood.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. Is it for sale? Because I'm not buying it.
Would you not buy that for a dollar?
After visiting their apartment several times, literally the first person besides their immediate family who'd ever stepped foot inside the front door, she slowly started to learn about their life, their backstory, and the unique situation they'd lived in for the last 15 years. Moselle started bringing her camera, conducting interviews with the family, and slowly shaping a documentary about the lives of the boys, who she ended up dubbing the Wolf Pack. Through Moselle's documenting of the lives of the family post 20 plus years of seclusion, she was able to capture the individual awakenings of each of the siblings, the fallout of their relationship with their father, and everybody slowly starting to create a life outside of the walls of their apartment. The documentary, titled The Wolf Pack, premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival and got wider distribution later that year. It received audience and critical acclaim, but more importantly, introduced the Angulo family to the world, which in their case was much more significant than just attaining 15 minutes of fame. With the premiere of the documentary, the brothers and Suzanne were able to travel across the United States and even some countries abroad, attending various screenings of the film, conducting Q&As, meeting other filmmakers as well as fans, and just generally stepping out into the world with a bang. This was like taking the training wheels off a kid's bike and then just immediately pushing them down the Grand Canyon. They went from living most of their lives inside of a small apartment with nobody to talk to but each other, to going on a full-on national press tour and meeting and speaking to thousands of people before they even, like, got into a normal school. More importantly, though, the film gave the family the confidence and also financial freedom to start building their lives even further. Without being locked up and subject to Oscar's strict rules, Suzanne was able to reach out and talk to people. She contacted her mom for the first time in 26 years and reconnected with her entire family.
What? Oh, when? Oh, You are? You know, you sound the same. You sound the same that you did 50 years ago. Well, I just want to say that I love you so much, Mom. You know, I just love you so much. But I just want to say that it's not like I've ever forgotten you. I've always thought about you, and you've always been in my thoughts. Yes. I know exactly what you went through. I have 7 children, and I do. Oh, Mom, it's so good to hear you. I'm so glad I called you. Yeah, sure. All right. I love you, Mom. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye. Yes! Yes, yes, yes!
The pan over to that mildly annoyed cat.
Yeah, it's like, shut the fuck up. You've never been this excited ever. What's gotten into you? Is it perhaps that you've just been freed from slavery? Watching Suzanne is so sad. She's like very clearly just a devastated human being. And it's even more sad because she has this particular, like, I'm low-key married to a maniac type personality where she just like won't be honest about her feelings on anything. So when she's interviewed, everything's very surface level. She's kind of going with the party line. She's saying things in like very charitable towards Oscar, saying things as if she agrees with the way that their lives are. But you can just see that it's a mask and she's just broken. Imagine you have to call your mom, who you haven't spoken to in 26 years. And like, number one, just like hold your breath and hope that like she's hopefully alive because she's 88 years old. And then you have to tell your own mother that you have 7 children. It's so sad. And it's all for nothing too. It's like, there's no reason for this. There's no reason that they did this. It's not really addressed directly, but there's some side references in an interview for 2020 where they kind of say that the reason why she cut off contact with her parents and family is because they just like didn't like Oscar and kind of didn't like the way he was like putting their lives together. And he basically was just like, oh, these people are trying to like come in and tell us how to live our lives. You need to stop talking to them. And so she cut off contact with her whole family and hadn't spoken to any of them in 26 years. They literally didn't even know where she was, or if she was alive or anything, for no reason, for nothing. It's just so sad. And she's just so clearly like a broken human being. Like, luckily later on, we see that she finds some degree of happiness and joy and the ability to go out and reconnect with her family and all these things. But still, there's no way of unringing the bell of that 26 years that she's just lost. Mukunda started getting PA work on various film productions in New York City, and through this work, he connected and made some of his first friends ever, other like-minded filmmakers. The brothers also started slowly moving out of the apartment, one by one, as they saved up money. Jagadesh and Krishna, the younger two brothers, changed their name to Eddie and Glenn. Mukunda started making really weird art films inside of the apartment using his family as actors. I just want to take a look at some of the scenes from these films that Mukunda made, which are in the documentary. I just want to take a look at these and just talk about them a little bit. Once again, knowing that the audience really can't enjoy this without being able to see it, but I just want to watch these with you and talk about them.
Spander, did you know that these are metaphors?
That's it's. It's really funny you say that, Dave. I definitely want to talk about that in a second. It's funny that you say that, Dave, because that's exactly what I was going to say. This is like Salvador Dali level of one-to-one metaphor parody. Just to describe this to the listener, it's like a short film. There's like a big cardboard window, which is clearly meant to simultaneously represent the world outside and then also like a TV screen. And Mukunda is like sitting watching this window, and behind it, it's like lit and has like a red backdrop. And then there's like a little platform thing that he built. It's like a rolling platform. And so like people keep getting rolled into the frame of this window for him to watch. And each person is like a member of his family. And they're just like these really over the top on the nose metaphors about like what those people represent. So at one point there's like a brother who's got like war paint on, like Braveheart war paint, and he starts like yelling, and it's like, oh, because he has all this anger towards this situation. And then he's got his father in it. Oscar is in the movie, and he's like, he's painted blue, or maybe it was purple. I don't know. I'm colorblind, but one of those. And he's got like a big eye on his head, and then he's got these two gloves, and then the gloves have eyes on them. And it's like, oh, because he's always watching us.
And the whole thing, there's a cardboard frame. So you're watching Mukunda look through a windowsill at these various characters that come and go, which is a metaphor because he's trapped inside the house and he's looking through the window into an outside world that he doesn't quite understand because it's a metaphor.
Yes. And then like his sister rolls by, and you know, the sister isn't talked about very much in this because she actually has like a neurological disease. And from what I can tell from the materials, like number one, they just didn't really want to involve her in anything. And also like she's just doesn't have the ability to like verbally communicate. So in the dynamic of their family, she's considered this like innocent. And so she just has this giant cardboard smile because she's like the happiness and the light of their family. And then the last thing is Mukunda got a girl that he met from doing PA work, like a young actress that also is doing PA work, and she's in it, and she gets wheeled into frame, and she's wearing like a dress, and she's got like hearts painted on her face, and it's like, oh, and she represents the temptation of the outside world and the love and desire of the world that I've been deprived of for my entire life. It's just like so like over the top simplistic metaphors. Once again, I don't want to be mean, but like it's just not very good.
Yeah, but he's like a fucking, he's like, he hasn't lived a life. This guy hasn't eaten ice cream.
I think that's exactly it, because the way that you think about this story is like, oh, these boys were locked inside of their house for 18 years and all they could do was make these movies. And the results are these like amazing works of like genius, you know, like Henry Darger type shit. But the actual work It was made by somebody who's literally never had a life experience. It kind of defies expectations in that way, because you watch it and you're just like, it's not particularly compelling. And then you think about it and you're like, but it makes sense, because these people have never lived. They've been inside of a vacuum of just their own selves.
You know why that this is like weird theater of the mind, Salvador Dali metaphor, right? Because he saw Lost Highway. Like, he was like, I have seen a David Lynch. That is awesome. I will do a David Lynch.
Yeah, this is 100% doing a David Lynch. That's like 100% what this is. They talk about watching Blue Velvet in here. I'm sure they watched Lost Highway. It's 100% a David Lynch. And Suzanne finally realized her dream of seeing her kids be in a field.
Look at that hillside there. Look at that. Look at that hillside. That is, look, would you look at that? That is beautiful. Oh, look at that. Oh, jeez. Look at those big pumpkins.
So basically, it's a scene from the documentary, but they take like an excursion out to like a farm, like a pumpkin farm.
There's Bunting's eyes. Why not ride? Bicycle, tricycle, automobile, Bunting's mother and a Ferris wheel.
And they're just playing in fields. They're running around in fields, and Suzanne couldn't be happier.
I gotta quit smoking.
That's so damn good. That's probably the best damn apple I've ever tasted in my life.
Yeah, running by and saying, I gotta quit smoking. That's so damn good. It's probably the best damn apple. It's like, it's all just like, this is the way that they say things in movies.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Suzanne developed a whole different life, no longer stuck inside the apartment, waiting hand and foot on her husband and 7 children. The documentary dedicates almost no time to hearing Oscar's perspective. For most of the film's runtime, he's never seen or heard from. He's shown in old home movie footage, but you never hear his voice, and for all the present-day footage, he exists as a looming, paranoid presence, always in some other room with a door locked, hiding, seemingly scared of being seen, in fear of Crystal and her camera infecting him with the disease of outside somehow. The camera doesn't allow him to get a say as the brothers tell their story. It isn't until near the very end of the movie that we finally sit down and hear him talk. And he's disturbingly nonchalant about the torture, pain, and confinement he put his family through. When asked if he felt bad about what he did to his family, Oscar says that he never meant to hurt anyone. He just didn't want them to be hurt by the outside world and maybe took it too far. But regardless of what remorse for his actions Oscar may or may not feel, it's too late for most of the wolf pack. Only Govinda still speaks to him, saying that he feels like he needs to forgive his father in order to move on. The rest of the brothers, even the ones who still live in the same apartment with him, refuse to speak to him at all. Their relationship is irreparably damaged, and many of them say that he is dead to them. In fact, in 2016, on the heels of the documentary's premiere, Mukunda did a TEDx talk all about how he overcame his father's oppressive rule through the power of imagination.
True. My life could have gone in many different directions. I could have been mad, I could have been angry, bitter, or messed up from my childhood experience. But my imagination sets me free from that. It helps me see hope, endless opportunities. It sets me free from self-doubt and from judging others. Before I walked out that front door, my imagination was the only place where I felt I was free. Now I'm out in the world doing all of these things I've always dreamed of doing, and it's better than anything I could have imagined. Imagination isn't just a fairy tale or fantasy. It's you. It's who you are. It's the power within you. Don't ever let anyone take that away from you.
Also in 2016, following the documentary's premiere and the subsequent splash of fame the brothers received, 2020 did a feature on their story. The piece essentially rehashes the story from the documentary, but with a few added details and a few surprises in store. For instance, the production set up for them to have dinner with Robert De Niro.
Old Dirty Bobby D?
Bobby D is on the scene.
On the menu, a surprise introduction to a man who was their lifeline in those dark days, locked in their apartment.
Hey, guys. I need all your attention for 1 second. I have somebody I want you to meet. Wolfpack, meet Robert De Niro.
Their reaction, Oscar-worthy displays of shock.
Robert.
Mr. Robert De Niro, it's an honor to meet you.
Robert.
Wakanda.
Their tongue-tied, starstruck.
Naranya.
We were just talking about you.
And after they sit to break the ice, Naranya asks the question Crystal taught them to use when they first started talking to strangers.
What are some of your favorite movies?
I like, Lawrence of Arabia, On the Waterfront. What's the one with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor?
Place in the Sun.
Place in the Sun.
Wow.
You've seen more movies than I have, I'm sure.
Just days before meeting Robert De Niro, the boys had actually filmed a tribute to him.
It's not just like meeting like your favorite actor in the context of like a normal person. It's like they're literally meeting like a god. It's like if Tony Stark was a real guy and then you just met him.
I mean, honestly, I would freak the fuck out if somebody brought Robert De Niro in. That's not true. I probably wouldn't freak out, but I would be very surprised if it was like, Davy Bakes, here's Bobby D. I would be very fucking surprised.
One day I'm going to do that to you, but then it's going to turn into a Chris Hansen encounter where Bobby D is going to be like, what are you doing here, Dave Baker?
No, it's Dave, I got you a present. I want you to meet Robert De Niro. And then it's just a Robert De Niro impersonator, but I can't tell the difference. So I'm just like, oh my gosh.
Man, I love having a friend who has facial blindness. It's so easy to shop for them. You can just spend $25 on Cameo and change their life.
I would be so suspect of that. Like, my initial shock would give way to, like, what's the prank? Where is this? What's the bad part of this? Is this Robert De Niro here to tell me that my mother's passed away or something? Like, what's going on? What is this? Like, I can't ever accept that something just good would happen.
You've been served. You're being audited.
Yeah, exactly.
By
exactly. You've been served divorce papers. I'm not married. That's what you thought.
I'm not married. Not anymore. And finally, most importantly, they pay to fly Suzanne and her 7 children out to Michigan to reunite with her family for the first time in 26 years. The brothers all moved out and started real lives. Govinda started working as a director of photography on indie film in the New York area. Mukunda kept PAing, which he continues to do to this day, though he doesn't seem to have worked on any of his own films since the two he made in 2015. Narayana became an environmental activist. Jagadesh / Eddie and Krishna / Glenn both started pursuing music. Bhagavan became a yoga instructor and hip-hop dance teacher. Vishnu, their sister, who actually has a rare genetic disorder, seems to still live full-time with her parents. And despite everything, Oscar and Suzanne are still married. Though, as she describes it, their relationship has turned a complete 180 since the days when she wasn't allowed to leave her own house. That's also another thing that I've never seen in a situation like this. Like, everything that you've just heard, listener at home, Davy Bakes, everything that you just heard, all that story, all the trauma, all the pain, Oscar and Suzanne are still married, and they still just are a married couple and live together.
How much of that is like, we're people of a certain age? And whether this is true or not, we feel that our chance at meeting someone has gone by.
That's definitely a component of it. I mean, it's not just even that. It's just like, it's that, but also, like, quite frankly, the effects of what has happened to Suzanne, at least from my perspective, are identical to the effects of somebody being indoctrinated and brainwashed by a cult. So it's not just like, oh, my life has passed me by. I'm no longer viable as a partner and I'm not going to be able to find love. But it's also like, to a certain degree, she still just thinks of him as like this fucking leader of her life that has guided her for the last 35 years or whatever. It's powerfully sad how this type of modern fear, which is essentially just scary fan fiction you create in your own mind, can utterly destroy your life, reverberate out and destroy the lives of those around you while it's at it. So many years wasted, a whole lifetime of experiences that Suzanne and her children still never get to know, all caused by one man's bad feeling. And the thing is, I can relate. There's a lot of fear in me. I think it's in a lot of people to varying degrees, but I'm certainly no stranger to it. Fear of uncertainty, fear of the unknown, of danger, of the chaotic variables of the world. It especially becomes pure and uncut when you have kids, You don't want them to get crushed by life the way that you feel like you have in certain ways. You want to protect them from hatred, pain, and all the negative experiences you went through. You know what's in store for them out there, and you just simply want to prevent it from happening, like a time traveler who has knowledge of an impending disaster. You know how it all plays out. You see the bad path, to borrow a line from the movie Looper. And you know that it can all be avoided if you just keep them here. Nothing can happen to them here. But despite that, you ultimately know that life doesn't live here. It lives out there. And if you're smart enough, if you care enough, you know that you must let go. Despite every neuron in your body firing off, screaming at you to keep them protected under the umbrella of your best intentions, you know you have to defy that programming and let them go. And it crushes you. But it's the right thing. And hopefully, if nothing else, the way that Oscar Angulo chose to give in to his every obsessive impulse to keep his whole world safe and protected inside of a mini world that he could holistically control can serve as validation that you did the right thing. Dave, you have any final thoughts on the crushing story of the Angulo family slash the wolf pack?
My first thought is, it's really fucking weird to me how that branding dehumanizes all of these people. Like the 2020 story where she's like, Wolfpack, meet Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what I'm bumping on there, but it really makes it feel dehumanizing and strange and fetishistic in a way that I don't like.
And you're right, because the name came from, like, it was a nickname that Crystal Mosell gave them, where basically, like, they were running around, or at least that's how the legend goes. They were running through the streets of New York, and she's like, they're like a little wolf pack. And it's like, no, motherfucker. They're like a deeply traumatized family of abused children. They're not the fucking wolf pack.
Yeah, I can relate to a lot of the stuff in this, you know, as a chronically inside person. I totally get the madness of being lost in a world of your own making. I feel really sad that these children went through this. I think it's compelling and fascinating on an anthropological level. In a way that it's very difficult to define, there's a part of me, I think, when I was younger that would have thought that this life would have been good. Does that make sense? Where I was like, I just want to be inside and make my fucking art all day. I don't want to deal with people. I don't want to go out.
Trust me, baby boy. I understand. I'm sure we've talked about this on the show before. It must have come up. We definitely talked about it in real life. We talked about this with my wife a couple weeks ago when we were in Little Tokyo. But like, no insensitivity meant towards the many people who were affected in various ways, including death and disablement. But I was having the time of my life during the pandemic. But the thing is that in a way it was forced seclusion, but it wasn't a person. It wasn't like a person telling you you can't leave. It doesn't feel good to not be able to leave because of a force of nature, but you can almost resign yourself to that. You're like, ah, well, what are you going to do? The dynamic shifts when it's a person saying you cannot leave out of this house, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I don't fully mean that in the way that I think it might come across, but I relate to the monastic, habitual, interior life. Not even just in the literal sense of the word, but I mean, in the, like, as somebody who, you know, is interested in strange esoteric things that not a lot of people want to talk about. So you end up just kind of living in your own head, perennially going down, you know, YouTube and Wikipedia wormholes. And it's a miracle I'm not radicalized at this point. Like, I should be the one who breaks the podcast up, because I'm like, no, you don't understand. QAnon, man. Like, you know,
you're like one molecule away from that just being you. You're almost there.
I deeply relate to some of the things that I went through in my childhood and my natural proclivities as a person. And I wish that these poor people didn't have to go through this. But I am not immune to the one of us circus freak glitz and glamour appeal. And so obviously I love this. I'm so fucking into this. What are your final thoughts?
Similar to the thoughts on the Shags, the fact that this was a family that was deeply traumatized and abused by a tyrannical force is almost kind of glossed over a little bit in favor of this, like, isn't it crazy that they made remakes of movies and they just love movies and, like, that's all they talk about? In a weird kind of, like, fetishistic way that you were saying. Like, the documentary does not shy away from the realities of it. Like, it's not that. It's not like completely glossing over it and only focusing on like the quirkiness of it. It does grapple with that stuff for sure. But it doesn't grapple with it as much as you would expect it to or want it to. And then certainly like the coverage of it outside of the documentary, the news stories, the 2020, it's all just like these wacky brothers that made guns with cardboard and made movies. And nobody's like, no, these people were being psychically brutalized for like 20 years. This is a person who should like go to jail, I think. Like nobody talks about it in those ways. And it really speaks to what we talked about earlier, the packaging and framing of something that can just completely sell it as a whole different thing. The fact that if the Angulo family existed now and they were in the place that they were 20 years ago now, they would probably be a TikTok channel with 5 million followers. And there would be people saying this is weird and, oh, I'm going to make a stitch and talk about how they're being exploited. But like most people would just think of them as like the kooky family who like makes weird things from their house and never leaves or whatever. And the way that it's been addressed in the news is a similar thing where it's all packaged as like the weirdness of the brothers and the way that they grew up. And it's like, no, this should be discussed as like this horrific psychological tragedy that should be avoided at all costs. And also like, I think this guy is a criminal, but it's not. And like I said before, it's the worst case scenario nightmare of somebody who wants to protect their family. And it's the cautionary tale of like, don't allow yourself to go down this path of obsession to the point where you want to protect people so much that you end up being the arbiter of pain.
On that note, I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
This has been Deep Cuts. If you'd like to find me on the internet, you can do so at heydavebaker.com. On the socials, xdavebakerx, please go purchase my book, Mary Tyler Moore Hawk. I think it's cool. Maybe you will too. Spandrew, where can people find you on the internet?
MTMH.
Oh, shit. Look at that book.
Fresh copy right here of this. I'm sampling the supply. We aren't just making this up. It's a real book. I'm holding it right now. There's proof. If you want to get our dear beloved Papa Pricey's book that he made before his untimely bisecting, you can go to dapricewrites.com and get Deadbolt AI Private Eye, a comic about a robot detective solving crimes in the future. You can follow us on social media by going to Facebook and searching Deep Cuts Podcast. You can join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group where we talk about the show and make memes. You can join our Discord server, bit.ly/deepcutsdiscord, where we talk about the show, make memes, and play games and other cool stuff. We're coming up on an episode coming up soon. We're going to be doing another round of listing off names of people who have been participating in the counting game. Because I think they're up to like 1,100 now. So we've got a big list of Discord members that we're going to shout out on the show for getting us to over 1,000 in the counting game. And if you want to know what that means, join the Discord server. You can follow us on Instagram at Deep Cuts Pod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow me on TikTok at Dead Boy Detective, where I make little videos about interesting topics and facts and trivia and other stuff. And you can come live in the Mystery Treehouse and we'll never let you leave. And you can't go out there because it's dangerous and the world wants to kill you. So stay with us forever. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.
The incidental music for this episode was created by D. Catalano, whose music can be found at wekeepoddhours.bandcamp.com.